Okay, we'll now open the floor up to questions. I can see it's a little bit more difficult for me to navigate my way through the audience here, so I'm just going to pass off the mic to the first questioner, and then I'll stand back over here in the corner and take the speakers. Ask you. So, first questions. Oh, and I should also mention the same rules as yesterday. Students first. Once we've exhausted that, we'll move on to the professors. Hope it's not as quick as yesterday, but give it a shot anyway. So, if there are any students that have a question that they'd like to ask, please come forward. You're not a student. Not technically. No one? Okay, professors. Move on. So, just pass the mic back.
Yeah, Warren, thank you very much. Wonderful contextualization. I just wondered if I could add a little bit to the early 70s contextualization, mostly for the students who probably don't have as long a memory as you and I have. So, I think when Foucault was being read in England, I think another factor was that Madness and Civilization was mapped onto R.D. Lang's work. So you got a group of, students may not know this, but there were a group of quite radical psychoanalysts in the UK doing interesting work under this guy named R.D. Lang. And Warren probably knows more about him than I do. But then when Foucault's Madness and Civilization, about the history of psychiatry and incarceration and this distinction between the mad and the reasonable, came out, there was an immediate connection was made with R.D. Lang and this movement to get people who were said to be mad out of this insane asylums and to break down this. And I think that part of the explanation for Foucault's influence in psychology, psychiatry, social work in England comes out of that connection. And a second, I'm just adding things, a second, and stop me if you disagree. The second one is the peculiar feature about British Marxism at the time. They didn't want to be these metaphysical nonsense theorists, but they didn't want to be British empiricists. And so what they had was history. And when Foucault came with these early works, even like Madness and Civilization, but especially Discipline and Punish, they took him to be a historian. And so you have a stream of British historians that saw a kind of affirmation of the distinctiveness of the British Marxist tradition, not theoretical in the way that A.J. Ayer and the logical positivists criticized, but not just common sense either, because they had British history, like Christopher Hill and so on. So you get a whole range of people found in a journal called Ideology and Consciousness, who were all, like Foucault, former members of the Communist Party. Foucault was in the French Communist Party. I think he lasted about a month. He couldn't stand it anymore. The conditions, right? And then in the 70s, there was a communist university at Cambridge. And all these young scholars who were doing their PhDs in the 70s couldn't stand the British Communist Party. And they didn't like the New Road. And so they left the communist university collapse. They founded this journal, Ideology of Consciousness. At first they were Althusserians, but then they couldn't follow the structural slide. But then they found Foucault as a kind of complementary historian. And then they founded a journal called Economy and Society. And that's all, Economy and Society is a reference to Weber. But for historical Marxists, it's a kind of way of signaling you're a left Weberian, so to speak, sort of like Stanley Hoffman in the States. It's a way of being on the left without saying you're a Marxist. And so you have a whole strand of Marxist historians around Economy and Society, still a very powerful journal in the UK now, who are Foucaultians and link together Foucault and the longer tradition of British historical Marxism.
Great comments. I don't disagree with anything there. Just in relation to your first point, I think, and again for the benefit of the students, that Foucault's work appears in the U.S. and Britain at a time when the welfare state is being criticized from many different points of view. And you get many, many scholars looking at the practices that are constitutive of the welfare state, both contemporary practices and historical practices, in a critical way. And so things like asylums, fit into that field of study. I think both non-Marxist and Marxist analysts, sociologists and historians, were thus very receptive to that aspect of Foucault's work in that context. And it just complements what you said about Lang. Raphael was next.
How important do you think the translation factor had played a role in the way that the English thinkers interpreted Foucault? I guess I take as an example the book The Order of Things, in which its English title is The Order of Things, but in French it was Words and Things, and it could be interpreted in different ways. So I guess how important, or if that played a big role in the way that the English thinkers read Foucault?
I think it did, but I couldn't give you an analysis with examples of how it worked. The title Words and Things had already been taken, interestingly, in Britain by a critique by Ernest Gellner of Oxford Philosophy, the type that Tom Stoppard was complaining about. So there already was a book out there in the early 60s. Was there another?
The Spines, Words and Things, came out.
It's Word and Objects.
Word and Objects, that's right. Yeah, sorry.
So yes, I think the translation played an important role. I mean, what generally I'd say of translations, particularly from French, is that they're often really bad, and they make understandable French into English that's very difficult to grasp. It's most obvious with regard to Derrida, but I think it applies to Foucault as well. But maybe someone else could answer your question better than I can.
Well, if you want more historical context, the translator of Order of Things was A.M. Sheridan Smith, who again was one of these interesting Marxists who had left the British Communist Party, moved to Paris, started sitting in on Foucault's lectures, and then came back and gave lectures around the UK. He'd come up to Cambridge, he probably came to Oxford, and you were there too, and started lecturing on Foucault and how he translated it. So I think the English, most English academics read French anyhow, so they would, I think there was a better understanding, at least, of the order of things. It's a difficult text in French as well, as you know. But there was a kind of discussion of translation around the order of things. I mean, Mandelson's Civilization was a disaster because it's only about half of it's ever been translated into English. It's a much longer book in French.
Oh, where's the
mic's
over
I just had a two-part question. One, as a student looking to read Foucault, it seems that there's a lot, or you've already mentioned that Foucault goes past Hegel and Marx, and I'm just sort of wondering what would be a way to prepare, what kind of back reading, what kind of things do you need to understand before you can get into Foucault, because it doesn't sound like something you can just, in third or fourth year, you can just start reading and you can understand where he's coming from. It seems like there's a lot packed into it. I've also heard that there's maybe some connection to Heidegger. I've just read some intro stuff to Foucault and just hearing where he got his influence from. And kind of the second part of the question is that it sounds, just from what you were saying, how Foucault does many of the things that we're taught not to do, that we're taught isn't good political science, really. And there's a sense that at one point, perhaps, reading and trying to understand him can push your understanding, but at the same time, there seems to be a sense of some danger in perhaps reading him the wrong way, or because he's, from what I've heard, he's just very flamboyant in his ideas. And I was just wondering, I guess that's a two-part question. One, how would you prepare to read Foucault, or what would you need to know going in? And two, just the question of is it easy to misread him? Is it easy to, I guess, mistranslate what he's trying to say?
Well, to read Foucault well, you would have had to have read everything that he's read. And that's, of course, course impossible. So, and I'm not sure that I can say, well, that you have to read this or that or the other. All I can say generally is that you have to be conscious that this is a man writing in a particular context, France of the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. Hence, a country in which politically Marxism is at the center, not in the fullest sense, but among the critical intelligentsia in France. That's at the center. Both a Hegelian kind of Marxism and a structuralist kind of Marxism that you associate with Althusser. And so that's the milieu in which Foucault is operating. And more generally, of course, the dominant philosophical tradition is not the one I was referring to, the British empiricist tradition, but the other one that the people that Stoppard is talking about are dismissing as metaphysical nonsense. So how do you prepare yourself? Well, I guess one way is to get back into that continental tradition and begin reading forward from Kant towards the present. And reading within the Marxist tradition as well. And then you begin to see what was different about Foucault. As for your second question, the danger for a student is that you mimic Foucault in his style without having read as much as Foucault. And you can make allowances for Foucault because even though I echo the kind of complaints that are made about him, that we all know he's read a hell of a lot, right? And is very, very sophisticated. And so we're prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, even though we can't quite see what the references are. And we may work hard enough to fill in the blanks to make those theories work. We're not going to do that with an undergraduate essay, unless you can show us that you've got the backing for it. We're not going to take you seriously. So don't mimic him in that regard. On the other hand, there are a lot of concepts there that have now entered into, to use a Foucauldian term, the discourse of contemporary social sciences that are not that hard to understand and that can be fairly readily used. June refers to the Journal of Economy and Society, a kind of neo-Foucauldian journal in many respects, and there's lots of work in there that I think is reasonably accessible. So one way of getting at Foucault is getting at him through the work of contemporary Foucauldians who try to deploy Foucauldian concepts for various analytical purposes. And then maybe you can go back from there.
If you take what you say is true, that Foucault's usefulness is in his ability to challenge comfortable common sense, then do you feel that Foucault as a political tool loses his usefulness in his third phase, which Jim outlined yesterday, in the sense that he advocates the situated freedom?
I think I might leave that argument to Rob. I suspect that it's going to come up in the second part. I find that aspect of Foucault less interesting than I do the earlier work. But that may be just partly a matter of personal taste and the kinds of questions that I'm interested in. I'm interested in the way that contemporary politics gets structured. So what Jim referred to as the kind of structuring move for me is the thing that I want to focus on. And I find Foucault very helpful in that regard. But there are other kinds of problems that you can address. And I find Jim's reading of Foucault in that regard, in the third phase, very similar, because it opens up a whole set of questions that may not be the ones that I'm pursuing in my own way, but are well with myself. So I'm hedging there, leaving the heavy stuff to Rob.
There
was a great talk. I just have, concerning the third phase, the ethical phase of Foucault, well, you put up the relationship between Kantian ethics at the beginning of the 70s, and then in 84, or at least 82, 83, Foucault starts writing a lot more on Stoic ethics and spiritual exercises. And I'm wondering, I mean, in the U.S., and he's coming to the United States fairly often, more and more, there's a community being built. And then in the U.S., there's you know, Peter Geech, Philippa Foote, Alasdair MacIntyre, this whole school that's going against Kant, in a sense, and they're trying to bring back Aristotle. And I'm wondering if there is a relationship between, you know, this Foucauldian ethical turn and that whole, you know, virtue movement in the U.S.
Good question. I suspect there might be, and I'm tempted again to throw it back to Jim, who was in touch with those people at the time and might be able to give us a more precise answer. Yeah, that's an interesting connection.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of piggybacking on the question here. I like the picture that emerges of Foucault in the 70s in the Anglo tradition is one of sort of emerging between the lines of an existing intellectual grid, so to speak. So I was wondering, what is it possible to say about how Foucault has contributed to reconfiguring that grid in some sense? Like, how has it become appropriated after the 70s? And you have Foucault invoked in all kinds of different contexts. I mean, even in critical political economy today, like words like governmentality, power, knowledge, etc., have sort of seeped in. Is Foucault still someone who is situated between different schools of thought, or is it just, I mean, is it too difficult to say anything about this?
It's a good question. My instinctive response is to say that he's been, to a large extent, domesticated. So translated, not just into English, but into an Anglo-Saxon way of conducting analysis, so that a term like governmentality is given very definite meanings, and it's deployed in a very definite way to analyze particular things. Or a term like discourse gets analyzed and used in a variety of different ways. So in that sense, it becomes domesticated and used, if I can use a Kuhnian term, used for normal science, normal social science, that isn't necessarily particularly radical in its implications. And yet, he hovers over it all in the way that Marx hovers over the work of Marxians. That if you go back to Marx from the work of contemporary Marxian political economists, you always discover new things. That he was a much more fertile, creative, challenging thinker than he's made out to be. It's the same with Foucault. When you go back to Foucault, he startles you. You thought you had him. You thought this concept was clear, and then suddenly there's a whole other dimension of what he's talking about. He's such a protean thinker. So there is still that kind of back and forth. And I think Jim is a good example of doing that now, in relation to that third phase of bringing new things into the conversation. But that's balanced by this kind of domesticated force.
Mike? Actually, my question is very similar to Bjorn.
Did you want to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. I just have a question regarding the debates that Foucault is kind of, the contextual debates that Foucault is entering into in post-war France. During that period, obviously there was lots of debates between people like Sartre and Merleau-Ponty on the role of the Communist Party in relation to Stalinism and all that kind of saturated or established the context in which this emerged. But also in France, there was the question of Algeria and colonialism and Sartre's adoption of third worldism and whatnot. And I know that Foucault is used in the post-colonial tradition to make sense of some of the power dynamics at play following particularly Edward Said. But I was wondering if there's any literature or anything that explains Foucault's himself relative silence on these issues, or if that's not the case, what directly he had to speak or say about it. Because I believe even he was, he wrote the archaeology, perhaps, I heard, in Tunisia, and so he, like, these things were alive well as well alongside other political debates at the time.
Yeah, probably someone else could better answer that than me, but from what I've read, I think the common criticism of Foucault was that he backed away from most of the major issues, not just that one. But he was at a distance from the May events in 1968 in France. It's hard to think of many sort of central political controversies at the time in which you could say, well, Foucault was front and center in the way that Sartre was in this sense. So it seems to fit into a practice on his part that fed into the criticism that I was repeating in the lecture, but somehow he was not there in relation to the major political struggles of our time. He was always somewhere else, as it were. So the most obvious campaign he got involved in was prisoners' rights, which is an important issue, but you wouldn't put it number one on most lists of the crucial issues of the day.
Last question.
I just wanted to ask a question about the relationship between the work of Gramsci and Foucault. Like, both, I think, to me, appeared similar in that they moved away from the view of state power as the monopoly of violence, exclusive monopoly of violence, to a more nuanced understanding of the forms in which power is distributed in society. Was there any, you said that, like, at the time, in the 60s, Gramsci had also been introduced among the readers in English-speaking world. Was there any understanding or the way in which Gramsci was received? Was there any similarity or differences?
Is similarity in the way Gramsci was received or how Foucault received Gramsci?
In the way Foucault and Gramsci was received.
Similarities. There's a sense in which Gramsci was much more important. This seems a odd thing to say now, but in the context of left politics at the time, Gramsci was the person who was pulled in to problematize the whole logic of the dictatorship of the proletariat and all orthodox Marxist accounts of how you could perceive politics. So if you were a young person on the left at the time, you went to Gramsci. I remember another play I saw in London at the same time was Trevor Griffith's Occupations, which was all Antonio Gramsci in the strikes in Turin in the 1920s, a lot of verbatim quotations from Gramsci's speeches at the time. That got us really going, because that seemed to give us a sense of how you could build a counter-hegemonic revolutionary movement and all that sort of thing. So the reception of Gramsci was really very, very important on the level. And again, to go back to what I said in relation to Bjorn, Gramsci got domesticated as well. So that there's kind of commonplace in international relations theory, Gramscian international relations theory, which is pretty tame stuff, compared to Gramsci the revolutionary of the 1920s and onwards. Foucault's reception, I think, was quite different because because it cut in much more at the intellectual level than at the political level. To the extent that it cut in politically, it cut into particular kinds of practices. So that people who perhaps have not questioned certain kinds of practices that were in the molecular structure of society, suddenly looked at that and said, holy cow, I better question that too. Whereas Gramsci seemed to speak to the very center of politics at a time of, this won't be familiar to the younger amongst you, but it was thought, many of us thought we were in the midst of a kind of titanic class struggle, global class struggle, marked by the events of 1968, but by other political upheavals in Europe and in North America that we all knew in our hearts we were going to lose, but well, some of us pretended otherwise. But you know, there was the sense that this was a particular time of possible transformation.
But I understand we've got one more question. I would be hesitant to deny myself.
Just a modest question. I wonder if you could talk about just any comments on the Canadian reception of the drive. Very specific reason for asking this.
Is that my question?
I don't even mind. Just let me just ask this. Because it's a really current question. I just got back from New York University where I was told don't mention the word Foucault because the Marxists will get too pissed off of you. Well, this is completely crazy, actually. And what is it about, as Marx makes Foucault really like a dangerous moment in Canadian thought? And I ask this because when I started teaching in 75 in the midst of a prairie wind snowstorm, the first book I taught was Discipline and Punish. And the Manitoba students took to Foucault like prairie grass fire wildfires. Because Foucault really provided for them a history of how to think of things like penology, how to begin to write the forbidden histories that had never been written, not in Manitoba, allowed to be cropped, the histories of Louis-Riel, to study the history of penology and say, well, why until well into the 20th century were the criminally insane, the poor, and women treated in the same penological categories? And so, what happens to these sequestered bodies? So there's a British reception on the one hand, but there's an ongoing Canadian reception. So.
I'm not sure that I can answer that question any more effectively than you can, Arthur. I think it is bound up with the revival of Marxism in Canada, and Foucault being perceived as a, particularly at York University these days, as a rival to Marx. That's how it gets framed. As you can go to Marx or you can go to Foucault, but you have to make a choice. And we know what the right choice is, and therefore better avoid this kind of dangerous stuff. That's my sense.
I think we're going to break now, and then we'll reconvene with Dr.